From the Radio Ranch in the heart of Liberty, Texas, it's the Bombastic Blogcast for Friday, January 10th, 2025. I'm the G-Man, Dan Gallo.
Hey, G-Man.
You're yourself. Defender of the peace, keeper of the justice, purveyor of truth, the kid with the patriotic red, white, and blue eyes, and one heck of a nice guy. And since it is Friday, let's do the Hawaiian Shirt Friday fight song. Come on, sing it loud and sing it proud. Truly the sweetest sound this side of heaven. Now, let's get things officially launched with
the Daily Datagram.
You got it. Words of wisdom, words of inspiration, brain droppings, or noggin nuggets, you get to make the call. I like this. It says, you better think about the future, for it's where you'll spend the rest of your life. Wow. And they've got a good point there. But I have to ask, why? Because in the future, you're going to be pining away for the good old days. And you may not know it yet, but these right here are the good old days.
Ooh, I like that.
Let's move along now to the so-called educational part of this big blogcast.
Twisted History.
Here we go.
Gather around, kids, because a lot of things happen on this day throughout history.
Oh, I know.
Some cool, some not so cool.
Exciting.
Just the same. You need to know your Twisted History.
If you say so.
You might be quizzed.
Yeah.
Yeah, you might be quizzed.
I don't think so. Well, kids, it was on this day in 1901, the first great Texas oil gusher was discovered at a place called Spindletop near Beaumont. And not long afterward, Texas went from being a big state to becoming a big rich state. And to this day, it still is. Yeah. And it was on this day in 1946, the United States Army Signal Corps successfully conducted Project Diana, bouncing radio waves off the moon and receiving the reflected signals. Talk about your long-distance dedication. There you go. I don't think anyone ever found a useful purpose for that technology. I guess they just wanted to prove to themselves that it could be done. Besides, it was taxpayer money. There's always plenty of that.
Are you sure this is legal?
In keeping with the theme that I started here, what, last week? Where Joe Biden on his way out of office is going to create as much damage as he possibly can. I guess to seal his legacy, such as it is, continues. Just finding out about this, found out about this yesterday. But the Pentagon announced back on Monday in the dark of night that they've released 11 Yemeni detainees with suspected ties to Al-Qaeda from Gitmo. Now, the detainees, none of whom have been charged with a crime, are going to be resettled in Oman as the Biden administration moves to wind down operations at Guantanamo. And the Department of Defense said in their official statement, although different processes, each of the Yemeni detainees underwent a thorough interagency review by career professionals who unanimously determined all detainees as transfer eligible, consistent with the national security interests of the United States. Really? The Pentagon noted that Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, who I don't trust any farther than I can throw him, and he's a big man, notified Congress in 2023 of his intent to repatriate these 11 Yemeni detainees to Oman. So apparently in the inner circles, everybody knew about this. This was in the planning stage for quite some time. It's just that you and I didn't know about it. Here again, no full disclosure from this administration. Of course, in all fairness, you don't get full disclosure from any administration. All right, just saying. So the DOD also said the United States appreciates the willingness of the government of Oman and other partners to support ongoing U.S. efforts focused on responsibly reducing the detainee population and ultimately closing the Guantanamo Bay facility. Mawath Hamza Ahmed Al-Alwi, an alleged Al-Qaeda fighter and bodyguard for Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, was one of the 11 men released. an unclassified 2016 U.S. intelligence file on Al-Awi warns that as a Gitmo detainee, he's made several statements since early 2016 that suggest he maintains an extremist mindset. The file also notes that Al-Awi has committed a number of disciplinary infractions while in detention that were pardoned as part of an incentive for detainees to improve their conduct. Let me tell you something. If this guy hasn't improved his conduct between 9/11 of 01 and 2016, he hasn't improved it by now. I mean, not without a lobotomy. Gee whiz. Then there's Suhail Abdul Anam al-Sharabi, another alleged bin Laden bodyguard who was also released. Al-Sharabi's 2020 intelligence file notes that he may have been associated with an aborted 9/11-style hijacking plot in Southwest Asia as a member of Al-Qaeda. Now, we're going to have some fun here, because I'm actually going to try to pronounce all these names. The nine others being released to Oman are Uthman Abd al-Rahim Muhammad Uthman, Khalid Ahmed Qasim, Hani Saleh Rashid Abdullah, Tawfiq Nasser Awad al-Bahani, Omar Muhammad Ali al-Rahman, there was no N in that one, Sanad Ali Yislam al-Kazami, Hassan Muhammad Ali Bib Hattash, Sharkawi Abdu Ali al-Hajj, and Abd al-Salam al-Hila. Wow. You know, you can injure yourself trying to do that. Now, this latest batch of transfers follows the Pentagon's December announcement that detainee Rida bin Saleh al-Yazidi had been resettled in Tunisia. Why Tunisia? You know, how do they arrive at these decisions? 15 detainees remain at Gitmo, of whom 3 are eligible for transfer and 3 are eligible to have their detention status reviewed, according to the Pentagon. Another 7 inmates are involved in the military commissions process, and 2 others have been convicted and sentenced by military commissions. What's to happen with them now? From this point forward, nobody knows. They're not saying. The Biden administration offered plea deals last year to alleged 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and co-conspirators Waleed bin Attash and Mustafa al-Hassawi. All 3 men have been held at Guantanamo since 2003. Now, the deals slammed by 9/11 families, naturally, have also been slammed by Republican lawmakers and the defense secretary. They're going to spare the alleged terrorists the death penalty just by virtue of these deals. That's it. The death penalty is now off the table. Damn shame. And the 9/11 families get hurt the hardest on this. Thank you, President Biden, on your way out the door. In yesterday's exciting blogcast, I did a rather lengthy piece on Greenland and also the Panama Canal, but to anybody who's getting the idea that this is an act of expansionism or imperialism, there's a method of the madness here. And nobody was able to explain it better than Bill O'Reilly, of all people. And here it is from BillO'Reilly.com. I want to read the transcript from what he had to say. Listen to this. It's safe to say Greenland hasn't received this much attention since Eric the Red spotted it and said, "Hey, what's that?" But now the modern-day marauder Donald Trump has his eye on the tundra, because lying below the permafrost is lots of oil and natural gas. In addition, other valuable minerals may be present, presenting a financial windfall to those who can harvest it. Greenland is not a country. It's a territory administered by the Kingdom of Denmark since 1721. If it were a country, it would be the 5th largest on the planet. But only 56,000 folks live there because there's nothing to do but make fun of polar bears. Now, Denmark is run by King Frederick X, a descendant of Gorm the Old, not making this up, who presided in the 10th century. Now, Fred looks like a man who could be reasoned with, so I believe President Trump can make a deal here. The Danes get a big piece of the energy harvest by giving the USA a 99-year lease to do the heavy lifting. Of course, to protect the investment, the American military would need to build a couple of bases. Now, that would torque off Putin, but blank him if he can't take a geological joke. Outflanking the Russians is a huge plus for America. So that's what the Greenland thing is all about. Copenhagen should definitely make the deal. Old Gormwood. So there you go. In the space of less than 2 minutes, Bill O'Reilly explained why Greenland is important to the United States. And by default, the entire Western world. We haven't heard a lot from Tucker Carlson lately, but believe me, he has been a busy guy. And lately he's been exploring the U.S. healthcare system. Somebody has to. Thank God it's Tucker Carlson. And he's been exposing how a profit-driven model overshadows fundamental patient care. Now, insights from Brigham Bueller highlight insurance companies accused of profiting from chronic illness. Now, who is this guy? Brigham Bueller, this is a guy who's been doing an independent deep dive on who's really cleaning up in the healthcare industry. Now, attention, of course, turns to the United Healthcare CEO's murder, and it hints at unresolved industry tensions. The opioid crisis is identified as a preventable disaster, demanding healthcare reform focused on healing over profit. Now, Carlson discussed the intertwined relationship between an unhealthy, over-medicated society and the resulting prosperity of insurance companies. Now, the current system benefits from prolonged illness, adding to their financial gain, of course. And Carlson provides an analysis with this guy, Brigham Bueller, who asserts insurance companies exploit chronic conditions for profit, overshadowing the primary mission of healing and patient care.
Let's talk about United Healthcare, since that's the CEO that was, you know, unfortunately assassinated. If we break down United Healthcare, they generated $373 billion in revenue last year. 60% of that revenue came from their pharmacy benefit manager, a holding company that nobody knows about. The general public, our politicians, they don't understand this and they don't get it. As an industry, the health insurance companies, and I said this on Rogan, they are the hidden juggernaut that nobody is seeing. Everyone's saying big pharma, big pharma, big pharma. Big pharma did, I think, $600 million. And you look at these big insurance companies, they did 2.5 that in revenue, 2.5 times that in revenue. They did $1.5 trillion. They're projecting that they'll do $1.9 trillion in revenue.
Now, mysteriously, the audio cut off there, but what he was going to say was by 2029. All right. Now, in-depth insights have been uncovering how insurance strategies prioritize profit over patient health. Now, any self-respecting business is going to always look at the profit margin, right? I mean, small businesses do it, big businesses do it, but do they do it to excess? Well, in this particular instance, it appears to be the case. The emphasis on treating rather than preventing illnesses keeps the cycle going. And practices like this have led to a system needing reform, pushing for a focus on health, not wealth. Is that ever going to happen? Well, maybe. I mean, the debate fuels calls for a shift toward patient-centered care that aligns with the core values of healing and well-being. Now, the segment titled The Assassination of the United Healthcare CEO highlights industry tensions. Now imagine that. The narrative raises questions about unresolved conflicts and the high stakes involved in healthcare management. And the discourse beckons a closer examination of how profits are prioritized in corporate strategies and the potential repercussions on leadership roles within the industry. And of course, you know, in any business, they're going to be looking out for the stockholders, right? Now, the opioid crisis further underscores these issues, and it points out how preventative measures could have averted many of its impacts. Because you got your oversight failures, all of that amidst self-seeking interests, and they've deepened the crisis. And of course, all of this emphasizes a need for accountability, which nobody ever seems to get. Reform advocates argue for a shift in focus toward genuine patient care instead of profit-centric motives that dominate the current model. Amidst these revelations, and the revelations in these in this Tucker Carlson program are many. Carlson's exploration calls for an urgent healthcare system overhaul. The demand is for reforms that place healing and well-being at their center. And somehow, I don't know how they intend to do this, but reverse the profit-driven trends. And adopting a patient-centric approach really necessitates, well, basically restructuring the methodologies and metric of success that drive healthcare today. Now, again, bear in mind that part and parcel of all of this is what happened years ago. Obamacare. You see, when Obama's administration decided that it was time to completely overhaul the healthcare industry in this country, and understand, too, that when they were doing this, deep down inside their argument was this push for socialized healthcare, nationalized healthcare, government healthcare. And we all know what happens when government does anything, right? You can kiss efficiency goodbye, and you can always assume there's going to be a huge ballooning of bureaucracy. So achieving real reform implies balancing profit with ethical patient care. And so to do this requires an absolute complete change in policy and accountability mechanisms to make sure that insurance companies align practices with patient health priorities. I mean, clearly the focus is no longer on the patient. The focus is on how do we profit from this? And this isn't anything new. My God, I remember when my second daughter was born. That was 1981. I remember seeing the invoice when we left the hospital with the baby. And on the invoice were two aspirin, $60. Two aspirin for $60 in 1981. Think about that. So this debate is going to continue for a long, long time, but the need for change is here. It's now. And it's clearer than ever, as highlighted by the issues, the many issues that Tucker Carlson's bringing to light. It's going to be interesting to see what happens if and when Kash Patel is confirmed as head of the FBI. The FBI's secrecy surrounding this Russiagate investigation into Trump continues to raise lots of questions, most of which I'm betting will never be answered. Now, there was a newly released document, heavily redacted, by the way, that highlights undisclosed motivations for actions that could potentially impact national transparency and trust. And right now, trust in the FBI on the part of the American people is pretty slim. And you don't need to be a political scientist to understand that. Now, a document newly released under the Freedom of Information Act, you know, FOIA, actually details the FBI's initiation of a counterintelligence probe against then-President Trump, which went down in May of 2017. Now, this probe was set into motion shortly after Trump dismissed James Comey as FBI director, which then, of course, sparked inquiries into Trump's alleged ties with Russian operatives. Now, the timing of the probe, initiated by then-acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe, remember him? Well, that coincided with rising tensions over the 2016 election interference allegations, and they were flying everywhere. They were flying like confetti, if you recall. And despite these serious accusations. Robert Mueller's investigation found no evidence implicating Trump in conspiracy with Russia. Yet a lot of details to this day still remain shrouded in secrecy. Now, the Steele dossier, which of course was bogus from the get-go, was funded by Clinton's campaign and was full of controversy. It played a significant role in persuading the FBI to consider Trump a potential threat. Inside the FBI, they were taking themselves seriously on this. So despite the dossier's credibility being compromised, not just once or twice, the FBI just re-engaged with its author, Christopher Steele, who was bogus from the word go. And this raised further questions about the Bureau's procedural integrity. Now, the idea is, and this is a quote from McCabe. He says, the idea is if the president committed obstruction of justice, fired the director of the FBI to negatively impact or to shut down our investigation of Russia's malign activity, you have to ask yourself, why would a president of the United States do that? Now, if you step back from this story just a little bit, it's easy to understand that logic. And this perspective reflects the underlying concerns that led to and perpetuated the Russiagate investigation. So with the investigation eventually having folded into Mueller's probe, which concluded without finding a conspiracy, the public naturally continues to question the validity of the FBI's initial actions. Now, the Justice Department has yet to fully disclose the logic, if any, behind the FBI's May 2017 probe, leaving a lot of people to wonder about the true intentions behind the measures taken against Trump. You know, this looked like a hatchet job. And an incomplete narrative actually persists about the FBI's actions and motivations. And it remains largely hidden from the public eye, despite the closure of the investigation in April of 2019. Yes, it has been that long. Now, the sustained lack of transparency over this period raises a lot of concerns about government accountability, particularly in intelligence operations. With critical details still concealed, a comprehensive understanding of the FBI's decision-making process seems to be pretty elusive, don't you think? Stimulating further critique and demand for clarity. And you can demand clarity all day long, but you're not going to get it without better leadership at the top. See, again, and we said this way back when we were first hashing through this a couple of years back. It's not the rank and file in the FBI who are the problem. It's not your field agents. It's not even your field office directors in various cities. The problem is at the top. After serving in Congress and being nominated to head the Department of Justice in Trump's second term, Matt Gaetz is now considering a significant political pursuit. You always wonder about these political types. Gee, what are they going to do now that they're out of a job? Well, a lot of these guys are lawyers by trade, and even while they're serving in Washington, they still have ties to usually a very lucrative law firm somewhere in the country. Gaetz withdrew his name, as you know, from consideration for the AG position because there were some ethics allegations. Founded or unfounded, doesn't matter. As long as the allegations are out there, they can torpedo your career. But now, as the publication The Hill reported, he's gearing up for a potential gubernatorial bid. Here's how The Hill reported it. Former Representative Matt Gaetz, R. Florida, said in a new interview that he's starting to think about running for governor of Florida in 2026. See, you have to understand that Ron DeSantis is term limited. After this term, he's out. He's got to find something else to do for a living, something else so that he can buy shoes for the kids. And then it says here, in an interview with the Tampa Bay Times, the former congressman turned television host said his chief concern would be handling the insurance crisis. Quoting him in the interview, he says, "I have a compelling vision for the state. I understand how to fix the insurance problem, and it's not to hand the keys to the state over to the insurance industry. If I run, I would be the most pro-consumer candidate on the Republican side." Now, I've watched him and some of his rants in Congress, and yeah, he does seem to be a consumer advocate of a sort. And he told the Tampa Bay Times that he needs more time to pray about his decision and discuss the matter with his wife. Now, speculation about his running to succeed DeSantis has been actually swirling around on social media for a while. Somehow it eluded me. I hadn't seen this. But in the wake of his latest interview, a lot of X users weighed in to express their support. Anthony Sabatini, who is a political operative, he says, "Let's go." So, yeah, there seems to be some sufficient support. Who else we got? John Solomon, independent journalist. He says Matt Gaetz says he's starting to think about a bid for Florida governor in 2026. And then he just put up a link to the website, justthenews.com. Now, in November, the publication of the Tallahassee Democrat reported that Gaetz had emerged as a potential DeSantis successor. Let me read something from that here. It says, Gaetz, 42, served as U.S. House Representative in Florida's first congressional district from 2017 until his resignation in 2024. He's made a name for himself by aligning with Trump and promoting MAGA-esque legislation and heightened his profile last year in leading the charge to oust then-House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. You do remember that, right? Things got a little inflammatory there. But Matt Gaetz stuck to his guns. So is governor his desired next step after not returning to Congress? Former Florida Representative Anthony Sabatini said in a tweet on Saturday that Gaetz will be the next governor of Florida. Gaetz responded with an image of the Florida state flag. He also retweeted a meme about Florida's cold front and wrote, "If I run for Florida governor, it'll be on my platform to outlaw frost." Well, that's certainly a good place to start. But, you know, would he make a good governor? You know, offhand, what I know of the man, I think he'd probably be an excellent governor. And he would be perfect to follow in the footsteps of Ron DeSantis, who's been excellent. Let's move on over to the Comedy Corner with Dan Viola.
You know, I like to people watch. I like to look at crowds. And, you know, all right, you can divide any crowd into three distinct age groups without knowing anything about them except how they use social media. Yeah. Teens, 20s, 30s. They like to keep up with their friends using a variety of different apps. Snapchat, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, Find a Tramp. What, you know, they use them all. They use a lot of them. Looking at this crowd, I think a lot of us are in the next age group. 40s, 50s, 60s. Oh, we keep up with our friends. We're pretty tech savvy because we're on Facebook. Have been for years. Why do we need anything else? Right? How many of you, like my wife and I, we reluctantly joined because she saw on the Today Show or something that in order to be an effective parent in the digital age, this is like 10, 15 years ago, you need to get on Facebook, make sure your kids are friends with you so you can monitor their online activity and keep them safe. Right? And what did the kids figure out? Within 48 hours, mom and dad are stalking me, so they left. But we stayed. Why? Because all our friends were doing it. Like, honey, I haven't seen this kid since Little League baseball. Whoa, what's he doing? Now I can keep track of all the important things my friends are doing, no matter where they live, no matter what time of day. Like, look at that chicken parm. How does he do it? Folks, what's wrong with us? Posting pictures of our food. What's worse, posting every meal that you eat online or clicking your approval on someone else's food that you're never going to see, smell, taste, or touch? No wonder our kids make fun of us. That's two age groups, right? Yeah, there's a third one, 70s and up. My parents are in this one. Believe it or not, they keep up with their friends using social media too. It's called The Obituaries.
I hereby declare the weekend as having begun. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on Monday's bombastic blogcast. Remember, no such thing as spare change, free lunch, or too much horsepower. And be sure to take some time this weekend to thank the good Lord that you're an American.
You mean that's it?